I'm going to call the meeting of the Tax Committee to order here. We are trying to get the tape going there, members. And thank you for being here timely. We want to welcome the members of the Property Tax Division and Chair Marquardt's Committee who aren't normally with us, who are going to be joining us today. And I think we're having our PowerPoint glitch now. But we're going to go to Mr. Michael first. I'm not sure that he knows that. And what we want to do, members, is we want to complete the final part of the orientation yesterday, and we will have the property tax members with us here, but much of what Mr. Michael's going to go through are actually property tax subsidies in the economic development part of the orientation. So we're going to quickly get through that, and then we're going to move to the property tax orientation. So with that, Mr. Michael, if you're ready for us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to pick up where we left off yesterday afternoon, I'll talk for maybe 5-10 minutes just about some general observations about using the tax system to stimulate economic development.
Excuse me. I apologize. Sorry. I want to tell members, the full tax committee knows that we have been working off a document Mr. Michael gave us yesterday. Jamie has reproduced it in your packets again, starting with the pages we didn't get to, and all the property tax division members should have it too. And the first page is, I believe, page 8, is that right? Let's all get to the right page here first. Yes, page 8, and the first slide is the one you see on the screen, tax provisions for economic development. Sorry about that, Mr. Michael.
I think it's useful to divide these types of provisions in a couple different ways. The slide shows a way that categorizes them based on what their purpose is, and I divided them up in three ways. One is that some of these provisions are just intended to stimulate overall business activity in the state. Another subcategory of these are provisions that are intended to help just one particular industry or sector. And third, there are some of these provisions that are intended to just change where business locates within the state. So that's sort of one way to focus on, well, what's the purpose? Another way, which I didn't put on a slide, probably should have, that another way to categorize these business incentives is whether there are general incentives that are available to any business that meets statutory requirements. An example of that would be something like the R&D credit, for example, or single sales. But another way that we provide business incentives is when government officials actually negotiate with individual businesses and determine whether or not they're going to get a benefit, and if so, how much. And that often is the most common case where that happens is with tax increment financing. No business qualifies automatically for tax increment financing, but rather they approach usually city officials and ask for assistance, or the city officials approach them and they go through a negotiating process. And so that's sort of two different ways that these business assistance provisions are delivered. The general, you meet the statutory qualifications, you get it, or do you have to negotiate with state and local government officials? So that's another way to think about these provisions. The general provisions, now going back to these three categories that I talked about initially, what's the general purpose of it? For general provisions, these are provisions that are just intended to encourage overall business activity within the state. And some examples are those single sales apportionment. That's something you all dealt with back in the 2005 session. You've probably noticed that the governor's budget is proposing accelerating that. And, of course, that provision is just, you know, designed to encourage businesses that sell much of their products and services outside Minnesota to put more of their facilities here by reducing their corporate franchise tax. Since it's a C corporation corporate franchise tax incentive, it only affects those companies that are organized as C corporations and doesn't have as much impact on partnerships and so forth, although it does have an effect there too. Another common provision is lowering CI property taxes. Back during the 1997, 98, 2001 property tax changes, that was a big theme. that was going on. A couple other provisions is TIF for economic development and abatement. Now, one thing that distinguishes those first two items with the last two items is the first two are of these provisions that are sort of generally available to any business that meets statutory requirements, whereas the last two, those incentives are only available when the individual business enters a deal with local, in this case, local units of government. Second category was when these provisions are designed to help a specific type of business or industry. Some common examples, the bioscience zone that passed as part of the JobZ provision, the provision that passed last year for international economic development zones, which I think most of you think of sort of as the air freight industry, the special provisions that were done for Northwest Airlines back in the early 90s, obviously the pro sports subsidies with the, you know, with the baseball park, football stadium is now another issue that's obviously going to be on the agenda again. The research credit might fall into this category because it tends mostly to help high-tech type businesses, although it's generally available to any type of business, and a lot of other businesses besides high-tech business will also qualify for it, but it tends to be concentrated more in the high-tech businesses. There's a general rubric, and this sort of goes back to this presumption about the market being the best way to make allocations. This common principle is that the government ought not to be in the business of picking winners and losers. Obviously, in this case, decisions have been made to ignore that and to say we think somehow we ought to particularly encourage the bioscience industry, for example, or help out the airline industry. Too fast here. Finally, the third type of these incentives are instances where we're trying to just change the location of where businesses operate within the state. For some reason, for some policy reason, for example, the JobZ purpose, a couple purposes for that. One was they wanted to encourage more activity in areas that were economically distressed or areas where there was a lot of public infrastructure that wasn't being fully used. So the idea, of course, is that there were labor pools that were available out there that weren't being adequately used, as well as highways and public utilities and so forth. Redevelopment tax increments, another classic case where you're just trying to change, you're not really trying to increase the total amount of business in the state, but you're trying to encourage it to go in a specific area, again, for some policy reason, usually a depressed, blighted area where real estate development may help out that city or use public infrastructure better. Border city zones are another example where it's used there to offset the disadvantage that those cities and communities face from the lower tax rates in the bordering states. The old enterprise zone from the 1980s and 90s is another example. Finally, just to conclude with a few observations about things to think about as you deal with these kinds of proposals. Obviously, the first question is, do these things actually work? Do the tax concessions actually encourage businesses to do what they otherwise would not have done, to invest? Now, the sort of the empirical evidence that's been studies that have been done by academic economists and others that don't have a dog in the fight, so to speak, come up with mixed results. And as I indicated yesterday, I don't know how much you can put weight on that, because it's very difficult to measure these results using empirical analysis. So the mere fact that studies don't show that they have an effect doesn't necessarily say that they don't have an effect. It's just they're not good enough to measure whether they have an effect. I mean, economic theory may suggest that there should be an effect, but we just can't measure it. But the studies are definitely mixed, and I think the weight of them suggests that many of these incentives are not effective. As we talked about yesterday, there are issues of constitutionality for some of these provisions, because essentially what we're doing is we're helping Minnesota businesses, local, trying to help Minnesota or local businesses, and of course the Constitution says you can't discriminate against interstate commerce, and so some of these provisions always run the risk that they're invalid under the Commerce Clause. Third observation is that with these individually negotiated incentives, there are high administrative costs because the government officials have to sit down and work out the terms of the deal. That's obviously, and it can be an expensive process because you've got to pay for the staff time that's involved and all of the work that's done. And so, for example, in tax increment financing, one rule of thumb is that the administrative costs oftentimes equal 5 to 10% of the cost of the incentive. And so to the extent that you're trying to give this assistance to business, that's an expenditure that's just lost. It's not really, doesn't benefit the business. Another observation is on some of these special provisions, if they actually have the effect of imposing higher tax rates, you have to think about the effect that may actually be a drag. So in other words, some businesses qualify for the provisions and they get the incentive, but if all we're doing really is then raising the tax rates that apply across the board, some other businesses will then have a higher cost of operating, and if we're not good at picking winners, in fact, if we're bad at that, the net effect may be that we're actually discouraging business activities. So that's just, something to keep in mind, there's some risk with doing this. It's not a risk-free enterprise, particularly if the net result is to not lower overall business taxes. And again, just the general observation, which we talked about yesterday, inevitably, you're going to get some of these incentives to people who would have done things anyway. And obviously, if you're looking at it sort of from an investment perspective, that's sort of lost money. Again, another caveat, with these negotiated deals, there's sort of an asymmetry of information. The business obviously knows exactly how much of an incentive it needs to meet its rate of return and do an investment. By contrast, the government officials that are negotiating with the business have to sort of estimate or guess at what that amount is. So you can guess that normally means that the deals probably will typically overcompensate or favor businesses. And so that's just another factor that causes these to not be a very cost-effective way of delivering incentives. On the other hand, I suppose you can say, well, if you negotiate a deal for each business, you may come closer to providing sort of more what individual businesses need than if you have just a general provision that applies to all businesses. But of course, the offsetting factor there is you have higher costs from negotiating those provisions. Final caveat, and I'm done, and I'll let you move on to the property tax stuff, is when you have these special deals, there's one potential effect, and that's that as members of the public see these special concessions that are given to some taxpayers and not to others, that has the potential for sort of undermining the public's confidence in the tax system and its fairness. And I occasionally get calls, and it comes up, for example, in the tax increment context, where competing, on tax increment, because of its nature, is given to businesses like retail businesses because you want to, in theory, redevelop blighted areas. Other businesses that compete with those perceive that it's not fair because someone else's property taxes are actually going to pay for their building, and their taxes are going to pay for the general cost of government. And so those kinds of things just tend to have the potential to undermine the public's confidence in the tax system.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. I know Representative Solberg has a question before that, and I encourage all members, if you have questions on this business subsidy portion of the orientation, to jump in. Mr. Michael started the presentation telling the committee that I had requested this portion of orientation. In the 8 years I've been on this committee, we haven't done an orientation on sort of the business subsidy part of the tax code, which is, as members I think can now see, a huge part of the tax code. And there has been no attempt to put a dollar amount, but when you add up all these ways we subsidize business, it's a big chunk of the Minnesota budget. And I thought it's helpful for people on the tax committee to think about it. And I should say, you know, the statewide business organizations that lobby this committee, actually, as you speak with them, they actually are not a big fan of picking businesses one over another. Yet the committee, and same in the Senate, and the governor of all affiliations tend to do these. I mean, we've never really been pure, and so I think we need to recognize that. But I also thought it's good for members to think about the context of all the ways we subsidize and make choices within the market through the tax code. And I just thought it would be helpful in that, you know, whether you're on the property tax division only or you're on the full committee, you're going to hear about them this year. And we need to sometimes step back and think about how it's affecting the whole system. The ones I can think of that are already, you know, kind of on the docket this year, that some will go to property taxes, but not all, and all the rest will all come to this committee. These are just the ones I've heard of so far this year. We have changes to JobZ, changes to TIF, changes to abatement. There's a proposal for FarmZ. There is the Mall of America. There are the Vikings. There is Thompson West. There are proposals in the governor's budget already for some business subsidy. And I don't have an opinion on all those yet, except for that those who know me well know in general I don't like them. But having said that, I know that this committee bipartisanly will make those choices. And I just thought it's helpful for members to think about the gamut of the whole area of business subsidy and to understand that often, again, our state associations are not supportive of these because they don't want to pick and choose between all their members within a certain segment of the business industry. So it's a little more complicated, and it often doesn't have state dollars tied to it because it's happening within the property tax system. But we do set the policy for that. So with that, questions in this area are helpful. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, Mr. Michaels, your provision that says businesses' activities would have engaged in it anyway, do we have any data that says that the Job Z was used for the but-for test at all?
Mr. Michael?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that there are some studies underway to evaluate Job Z, and obviously there, I think the statistics show that there have been, I don't know, over 200 agreements that have been entered into, you know, to buy Job Z tax benefits. And, you know, in terms of each one of them sort of would have to be analyzed individually. I got to believe that in some instances there probably was some activity that, you know, some level of which might have occurred anyway, but I don't know. I mean, that's, I just have not looked at that, and I haven't seen anything, you know, that's, you know, I know that somebody at the university called me. I believe the university's doing a study, but it's still in progress.
Madam Chair, I have a couple of instances of Job Z where one of them went across the road to expand so he could take advantage of the Job Z. And the second one was a newsletter from a business that was already being built and then was awarded the Job Z and said, just look how good we are now, in effect. I wish I would have kept the newsletter because it may have created some jobs, but it was never the but-for test that we should be very strong on.
Thank you, Representative Colbert. And Representative De La Forest.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Michael, I had a question. Essentially what we're doing here when we offer these subsidies and things is the government is interfering with market location decisions. And I'm wondering either as a general proposition or a particular proposition, if you have any data about situations where economically the state gained. You know, in other words, you know, what we're saying in a sense when we do these things is that government has better information than the market about where to locate. And overall, I'm wondering, you know, do we benefit from this? When does government have better information than the market about where economic activity should take place?
Madam Chair, that's the, you know, the $64,000 question, and I think from an economic theory point of view, there's a high degree of skepticism about instances where you know, government officials can are better at sort of making those kinds of decisions than the market. And so I think the presumption is that in most cases, if you accept that premise that market allocations are the best, you know, way to make those kinds of decisions, it's, you know, the presumption generally is that it's not, it's going to be suboptimal, to use the sort of economic term. Nobody's, to my knowledge, sort of successfully measured or quantified what that is. Now, there are some times when the market fails, where there's public infrastructure, or there's some reason why private decision making doesn't accurately take into account the public benefits and costs, and that, from a theoretical standpoint, is when it's appropriate to intervene. But those are a very, you know, it's a small subset of, and most of these provisions are not really designed or intended to sort of deal only with that kind of sort of market imperfection. But yes, as a, you know, as a general presumption, I think, you know, if you talk to most academics about this, they would say, yeah, what's going to, your net effect is that you're going to reduce overall economic well-being in the state by engaging in this kind of activity. But I've not seen anybody that's tried to, you know, successfully quantify how much that effect would be.
Representative De La Forma. Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would think that there must be some advantages to moving a business from another state to this state. But certainly if you're going to move businesses around from within the state, it's probably net, if not costing money, and you'd have to weigh the benefits of what it's costing you to bring somebody in from South Dakota, Iowa, or whatever. South Dakota certainly has made a practice of moving businesses out there with their tax policy.
Mr. Michael.
I think your observation, there's the insight of your observation is that it sort of depends upon your field of view or your, you know, where you sit, sort of, you know, where you stand depends upon where you sit or something like that. you know, if from a state perspective, if, you know, if that's your view of your, the, you know, the area that you're analyzing, you're absolutely right. There's an incentive and there's a benefit for the state to sort of bring in people from other states. But then if you're a member of a city council or a county board, you know, and that's why there are these differences between state legislators traditionally and local officials on the use of tax increment, which is largely a mechanism that's explicitly designed to sort of reallocate where business occurs. And so from the city council's perspective, this may be a great development because it causes business to move from city A to city B. From the state's perspective, you may think, gee, that's not a winner. There's this sort of separate question, of course, whether these efforts to get business from other states are really successful. That's a key question that we don't know the answer to all the time. And these, you know, taxes are only one component of the costs that businesses face. And if, you know, it's like I say, it's hard, you know, it's hard to know exactly how much you need to give them to come, and because we've got cost differences. And if you give them too much, then you're wasting the money. And if you don't give them enough, it's not going to have an effect. But the businesses that qualify for what they would have done, it does have a cost, and so you drive up the tax rates higher, which affects some other business. So it's a very complicated, difficult thing to know, and we're largely operating in the dark because we don't have hard empirical evidence.
Representative Mullery, and then we're going to move to property taxes. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Michael, I know you weren't, I don't think, a huge fan of the TIF at its most uncontrolled point. And I think we did have what a lot of people would call an out-of-control TIF at one time here. Is Job Z, from what you've seen, starting to head in the same direction?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I must confess that I have, you know, I worked on Job Z when it was enacted, but I have not spent much time at all, sort of virtually no time sort of evaluating how it's been used. I'm hoping that there are other people out there that are going to do that, so I really don't really have an informed opinion on that.
And Mr. Michael Epstein-Mullery, that was an excellent example for the whole committee of the diplomatic responses we received from House Research, and we appreciate that, but I think, Representative Mullery, your point is well taken. Other questions on this portion? Otherwise, we're going to move to property taxes. And I think Mr. Hines and Ms. Daltner, I'm not sure who's joining us on this. We're going to start with Ms. Stone. And members, you know, how I'd like to proceed is to ask questions as we go, particularly the members of the Tax Committee who are new to the Tax Committee this year or are new to the Property Tax Division. There are no questions here that are, the members who sat on taxes a long time will sit patiently while all the questions get asked, because that's what we're trying to do here today, is get the big picture on property tax in Minnesota. So, Michelle.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We're working from two documents. You should first have a PowerPoint, probably a very much smaller version than what I'm showing to you, but it's entitled Background Briefing on Minnesota Taxes. And then secondly, you have another document, more detail, overview of property taxes. This is a collection of reference documents, about 39 pages, short subjects. And it's this year, for your pleasure, it's got a table of contents so you can go through it and actually see what we're doing. This is going to be somewhat like the evening news. There are four of us that will be coming to the panel here to give you testimony. First, I will lead off with an overview of state and local taxes and then return another point for an overview of the property tax relief set of programs. Karen Baker will cover things like property tax administration, truth in taxation, limited market value and property class rates, mining and property tax refunds. Steve Hines will cover things like statewide property tax county program aid, market value credits, homestead and agricultural, school district levies and fiscal disparities, and then Pat Dalton will cover LGA local government aid and levy limits, and we will try our best to answer any questions that you might have along the way.
Michelle, if I may interrupt you, I think that was just wonderful, and I hope the public got to hear how complicated just the agenda for property taxes. So that was a whole pile of issue areas, and members know that there are many more. These are the big ones that all of the legislators here grapple with. So thank you, and we will try to move as quickly as we can to just do a broad brush, but lots of questions.
Okay. Thank you. Starting on page 2 of your PowerPoint presentation, you've got a pie chart for state and local taxes. Combining all state and local taxes in Minnesota, FY 2007 tax revenues are expected to reach $23.1 billion. As shown by this pie chart, individual income taxes bring in the most revenue at $7.2 billion, or about 32%. Next are property taxes yielding $6.6 billion, or about 29% of the total. Statewide sales taxes are third with about $5 billion, and other state taxes, this includes portions of Mr. Michael's presentation a few days ago, including corporate franchise gas tax, excise taxes, other kinds of taxes, are slightly under $4 billion. Of this $23.1 billion in tax collections, the split between state and local taxes is about $17 billion to about $6.1 billion, or a ratio of slightly less than 3 to 1. On the next page, we have a bar graph that gives a 10-year comparison of the big three taxes, income, sales, and property taxes, for fiscal years, and these are just selected points in time for which we had data, 1997, fiscal year 2002, and 2007. Note how the sales tax grew from FY 97 to 02, and then since has remained stagnant, that the income tax was stagnant between 97 and 2002, but has grown notably from 2002 to 2007, and that the property tax dipped slightly between 97 and 02 and then has spiked since that time.
Excuse me, Representative Solver.
Very quickly, are these numbers adjusted for inflation?
Yeah, they have been.
Thank you.
that's just to give you an idea of where the property tax receipts lie in relation to the other big taxes. Not seeing any further questions, we're going to move on to Karen Baker, who will begin the discussion on property tax administration.
Thank you. The next is a flow chart of who does what in the property tax system, and very quickly I will kind of, it's a very basic overview. We know that counties are responsible for the property tax administration, and Department of Revenue provides assistance and oversight. But with the county system, there are several different players or actors. You can see at the top of this, it shows assessor. He's out there, he's valuing property, he's determining class rates, he's sending out the notices of valuation to all the taxpayers. And then if you look on the left side of that, where it says property owners who disagree, if they don't like the assessor's values, first of all, they should talk to the assessor, because they may be able to work out or talk to the assessor about why the value is what it is, and is the value, is the market value appropriate. If in fact they're unhappy, there's two avenues of appeal. One is the boards of review. That is the local board of review, county board of review, and then people can go on to the tax court. Or the second avenue of appeal is directly to the tax court, and in the tax court there's two different types. There's the regular division, that's a very formal division, where you need an attorney, and if in fact you get a decision that you can appeal that decision to the Supreme Court. Where there's also something called the small claims division, that is one where homesteads and property under $300,000 can go, and it's much less formal. However, the decisions are final and you can't appeal them. Going on the right side of the ledger, the taxing districts are going through their budget process. They're certifying and deciding how much they want from property taxes. They're certifying that proposed levy, and then at a later point their final levies to the county auditor. The county auditor then is determining each taxing district's total tax capacity or tax base, and we'll get into some of these terms in a few minutes, calculating final levies and preparing truth and taxation notices. And then the county treasurer, and in some counties, the county auditor and treasurer are merged offices. So you'll see like the Department of Property Taxation where these don't show up as separate offices. But the county treasurer is mailing out property tax statements as well as collecting all the property taxes and distributing all those property tax payments or property tax receipts to all the local governments. Moving on then, just in general, the property tax timeline, this is really showing that a single property tax cycle really spans more than two calendar years. For example, if we're to take for taxes payable in 2007, the beginning point is really January 2nd of 06, and that's when assessments are made. So whatever property is sitting on that land, and for instance, if you had a house that was being built, whatever portion of that house that was being built as of that January 2, 2006, is what value would be put on. Then each jurisdiction determines its levy between September and December, and the reason why we kind of have that time frame is because they propose one and then they determine a final one after truth and taxation, of which we'll also mention later. And then the pay 2000 cycle doesn't end until after the second property taxes are paid in October and November of 07. Now, on page 7 of the handout, that there's a lot more detail of all of those various steps. I just kind of hit the real high points. So at some point, if you want to go back and look at the individual steps that occur. The next slide is truth in taxation. This is a law that's been in effect since 1988. It was the legislature put it into effect to enhance public participation in the system. From 89 to 93, it was on a pilot project, and beginning in 93, we had its first full year implementation, and that was the same year as the general repeal of levy limits for cities and counties. That was done simultaneously. This is the main, prior to truth and taxation, the main avenue that taxpayers really had is they see their value notice in one spring and not see anything until the following year when they got their tax statements. So it was like a year later before they really saw anything. And what truth and taxation does is it puts a few steps in the process, hopefully to get more of this public participation. The main steps are shown on this slide. One is a newspaper advertisement, which discloses what the jurisdiction's proposed levy and spending amounts actually are, so that taxpayers can look in the newspaper and see what these total amounts, and that actually shows not just the levy amount, but what these total budget amounts are. The next part of it is the TNT notices that everybody receives, and these show if, in fact, the taxing jurisdictions pass or adopt what their levies are proposed, this is what will happen to your property taxes, or this is what your property taxes will be on your home or your business or whatever. One thing that's been a real concern and raised a lot of attention is that that does not include referendum that's passed like at the general election. And so people see that and they see that their tax is going to go up by $200, and then lo and behold, a big referendum has passed and their final property tax is significantly more than that, and they kind of forget about that. The next part of it is after these notices come out, it says on there when there's hearings, and there's public hearings that are held where the public can come and discuss. Now, hearings are not required unless the proposed levy for a jurisdiction is greater than what your previous year's was by more than the IPD. And the IPD that we used this last year was 5.8%.
Can you define IPD just for the committee?
It's the implicit price deflator, which defines what the growth has been in local and government services.
Thank you.
So that's a pretty high percentage, which means then that the property tax levy would have had to go up by, 6%, we'll say, before a hearing would even be required.
I think Representative Coles is wanting to make a point related to that.
Okay.
But, and then we'll go to Representative Paymar. Representative Coles.
This is a question specifically to that. Do we have information about how many municipalities were required to have the hearings, their property tax levy increased more than 5.8%.
Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, we don't have that. I'm not sure if the Department of Revenue receives notice of that or not. They probably don't. But I can sure call Revenue and ask if they have any idea. But, of course, the higher that number is, the less that are required, and so this year there may not have been, and this is the levy increase, so.
Madam Chair, Ms. Baker, if you have that information,
okay.
I'd be interested to know that.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, Ms. Baker. Are all of the 87 counties, are the assessors required to use the same formula, the same standards, the same guidelines in assessing property? I mean, this is one area it seems like constituents call us and they're just flabbergasted by how their property gets assessed. And
Representative Paymar, I also know that Chair Marquardt is planning to do some extensive work, and you're on that committee, in the assessment practice area, and that is continues to be a big concern in the tax area. Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, like I mentioned, the Department of Revenue oversees and sends out guidelines and works with the assessors. We sure hope that all the assessors are on the same page. However, we do have a lot of assessors out there. And this is something which is just an ongoing discussion which needs continual overview and continual kind of looking into seeing what's happening, because assessing is not an easy job for them. Assessing is, when you think about it being an art and a science, I think it's as much one as the other. And so, depending on what type of property we're talking about, how many sales they have, it is just not an easy job. And I think the Department of Revenue is doing a very good job. I think they're I think their oversight now has really been beefed up, even in the past couple of years, over what it was before. And like the chair said, Representative Marquardt's division, I think, is going to dive into this area a lot more because the legislature requested a few different reports, some of which are very much connected to your question. Mm-hmm. And I think some of them will be discussed in Representative Marquardt's division.
Representative Famer.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Getting back to Representative Cole's question, when you're finding out the information, if you could actually find out as well of the mandated cities or the cities that were not mandated to have hearings, how many actually did still have hearings? Because I would bet that you would see that it is a habit that local units of government have, and even many, even if they were not mandated, probably did anyways. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Cole.
Karen, Ms. Baker, I see that this is your last slide on truth and taxation. So before you leave that, can you talk generally? I know last year the governor had his satisfaction postcard proposal that was kicked around here. What are other states doing in terms of citizen involvement in property taxes? Are they using mechanisms like truth and taxation? Are there other states doing other types of programs to try to involve citizens in the process?
Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, well, first of all, we all know that Minnesota has a more complicated system. And so I think, you know, just our classification system complicates the property tax system so much more. That and in a lot of other states, you have no class system, or if you do, you have, you know, very, very minor. And so I think that really minimizes kind of the public involvement, or at least what they feel that they need to be involved. I'm not real familiar of other systems that are out there or other states that have. We picked up a lot of the truth in taxation at the beginning from something in Florida that was kind of similar to that. And to be honest, I have not checked with what Florida is doing now. And I can sure do, you know, a little bit of checking to see. But I don't know of any other states, or I've never been brought, it's never been brought to my attention that any other states send out a pre-notice kind of like we do with our truth and taxation notice. Because in effect what that is it's another property tax statement, except it's one that says this isn't a bill. This is only telling you what it's going to be if in fact the proposed levies are adopted. So
thank you.
It's doubling the system, or doubling the work really for counties.
Representative Cole's question, I think it's just helpful for the committee to hear you respond on the classification rates and remember, think about that in other states, homes, cabins, businesses, everybody's taxed at the identical rate, regardless of value. Can you tell the committee how many rates we have currently, just so people understand the complexity? I don't have the Minnesota tax handbook in front of me, but it's right in there. I'm sure Mr. Michael or someone can grab it. But just so people can understand that in trying to build in fairness into the system, we give up on simplicity. We have lots of classification rates in the Minnesota property tax system, and the alternative is, you know, simplicity with some unfairness built in. Maybe you can look for that. It changes all the time, but roughly where are we at?
Madam Chair, I think we only have 5 class rates. However, we have a lot of classes. And the assessor has to put the property in the appropriate class. And so when you look at, for instance, Class 4, I mean, Class 4 has all of these various subclasses. And and we'll be getting to some of that later.
Okay.
So why don't we hold on? The one other thing I was going to say before I leave truth and taxation is one of the complaints that assessors in particular have with truth and taxation is that when people go to the truth and taxation hearings, what they want to talk about is value. They really don't want to talk about the taxes themselves. They look at the value and they say, my value's gone up from, you know, $200,000 to $250,000. Why? And that is not the appropriate place to deal with valuation increases. And that's something that, you know, we really need to look at and deal with and see if there's a way of addressing valuation in, you know, pre-truth and taxation in a better mechanism, because that that really is the time when too many people want to address that. Moving on to the next slide, real quickly, we've got a lot of property tax terms. These are just a few of the basic terms. Taxable market value, that is, for most property, that is the same as estimated market value, but in the case of some property that's limited, it's the limited market value. Net tax capacity, this is when you take market value times the class rates, you get net tax capacity, and each local taxing jurisdiction sets its levy, and levy divided by total net tax capacity equals a jurisdiction's tax rate. And total net tax capacity is really total tax base. Gross property tax is the net tax, or gross property tax is the net tax net tax capacity times the tax rates of all taxing jurisdictions. So it's the total local tax rate. And then net property tax is just the gross property tax minus any credits. But we will, again, Steve is going to go through some a hypothetical example and talk about some of these terms in a lot more detail. The last thing I'd like to cover real quickly is limited market value. Limited market value was put into effect way back in the 70s. Then it was out for a while. And since 1993 to present, it has been in effect. It applies to ag property, residential, seasonal rec, and then we added timberland in 2001. For pay 2007, growth is limited to the greater of either 15% increase over the previous year or 25% of the difference between what your 2006 was and what the assessor says the 2007 is right now. Limited market value is being phased out. Beginning in pay 2010, it won't be in effect any longer. For pay 2008, for instance, that equation, which was 15% and 25% for this year, will be 15%, 33%, and then it'll be 15%, 50%. So that's the phase out. It used to be that the big difference in limited market value and what was excluded was in residential property. That's no longer the case. Now most of that value is sitting in ag and also seasonal rec. And I don't have down what page 13 of the big handout has the 33 million that is limited by, or I should say excluded by LMV, and how much of that is by property type. And you can see that half of it is ag, or just about 14 out of the 33 million.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Well, could be.
Whoever.
We'll take it. Did we do a different phase out of that on ag land? Is that why there's so much more? Why the differential?
Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart. No, no, it's the same phase out. It's just that ag land, just in the last year or two, has been escalating so much faster that there is just a lot of value that has been excluded.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Leland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And here's one of those beginner questions, I suppose. Could you just talk a little bit more about limited market value and why it's being phased out and what that means for the system?
This will be another diplomatic answer. Maybe Ms. Baker, to tag on with Representative Liebling's question, you know, there's really, members, legitimate arguments to both sides of this coin, as members who've served on the committee know for a while. But in the context, possibly, of where does that value that's limited go? You know, how does that get picked up? And then the assessor's maybe perspective and, you know, the collectors of the tax versus maybe a resident or a cabin owner or any landowner might be helpful.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, in the case of limited market value, we know that if one limits certain property and you hold down that property, then somebody else has to pay more, right? Because what you're really doing is you're shifting it to other property. And I think what Representative Lynchewski was saying in her context was, you know, over the years, as this has been limited market, or let me back up a little, limited market value really came about because of very high escalating market values. And it also came because assessors weren't able to keep up, and when they did go out and value, they would put 40 or 50% increases on a property in 1 year. And so limited market value was a way that the legislature was addressing the issue of saying, we really think that no taxpayer should have more than a certain amount of increase in 1 year. It's okay to have X percent, but we just don't think it should be over that X. And the legislature has defined that X, and that percentage has changed over the years and through the limited market value kind of history. We're now at 15%, where the legislature has said 15% is a reasonable amount of increase to be out there, and yet there should also be a catch-up, because we want everybody to be caught up at some point, and that's why the 25% or the 30%. Now, the limited market value history is, we haven't repealed, of course, and the last time there have been bills to make it permanent, I think Representative Paymar had one to make it permanent as an example, but it also had the legislature has come in with other mechanisms to say we want to just delay it for 2 more years because we see other inflation. And I think one of the things, like, for instance, ag value. Right now the ag values are really increasing at a very, very steep rate. And so whether or not, you know, this gets delayed or whether or not it's left is entirely up to the legislature. But there's no question that if, in fact, you leave in limited market value, it does mean that somebody else is going to pay a little bit more than they would have because your value is limited.
Representative Mori.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this would be more for Steve. Do you know how much has been shifted in taxes from commercial onto homes because of the changes we've gone through on reducing limited market value in the last, say, 5 years, roughly that number of years?
Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I don't have any information on. So the question being, as we phased out limited market value, how much of that has brought tax burden onto those property classes away from commercial? I have not made any attempt to capture that information, no.
Other questions on limited market value? If not, we'll move on to class rates with Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, then picking up on page, now on page 14 of the longer document, as you, by now it's become apparent, Minnesota has what we call a classified property tax system, where each type of property has a different contribution to the tax base than one that would be determined strictly by its value. And that comes through the system through the terms that we call the class rate. Each class of property has a class rate, which you can see in the table in front of you. And many types of properties actually have more than one class rate, where we'll have a class rate for the first tier of property, which is some value up to a certain point, and then a different class rate for the value over that rate. Now, generally, the types of properties that we think of as the favorite classes in Minnesota's property tax system would be the residential homesteads and the ag homesteads. And you can see that the bulk of those, a residential homestead mostly is at a class rate of 1%, and ag homestead is, much of it is at a class rate of 0.55%, and the rest of it is at 1.0%. When we get on to the second sort of slide of the two and the class rates, you'll see that the less favored, let me go back to that. I guess commercial is on that first page. The highest class rate we have in the system is the one that is on the upper tier of commercial industrial property, and that is a class rate of 2%, meaning that the same value of commercial property basically contributes twice as much to the local tax base as that value of residential homestead were, to use the two most common examples of property. And if you look at, I guess, if I go on to the next slide, shows then how these class rates play out for, in terms of where you get to actually the net tax on a property. And so here's an example for a $200,000 property. Depending on what type of property it is, the tax varies from anywhere from $873 in this case for an ag homestead property to $5,143 for a commercial industrial property. You can see quite a range of tax burden for the same value of property. And I should add that is not just due to the class rates alone. That's the major part of it, but there are also there's a state tax rate that applies to some types of property but not others. There's a referendum market value rate that applies to some properties but not others. And we have credits that apply to some properties and not others, all of which go into the relative to make the burden different for the same value of property between different types of property. On page 15 of the longer document, there's a more detailed or a table similar to the one on the slide, but it has even more different types of property, and you'll see the range. You'll see where other types of properties, such as apartments, fall in that range as well. The next slide, then, which is page 16 of the longer document, now just looks at the state tax base as a whole, and you can see how this class rate situation plays out in total. Residential homesteads constitute almost 60% of the market value of the state. So that's 60%, that's been increasing quite a bit in the last 4 or 5 years. Commercial and ag property is next at 13%, commercial industrial at about 12%. The right-hand set of bars show then the contribution of that type of property to the total tax burden in the state. So residential homesteads constitute 59% of the market value and pay about 48% of the total property tax burden in the state. Ag property constitutes 13.5% of market value, about 6% of the total tax burden. Commercial industrial, about 12% of the market value, and about 30% of the property tax, etc. So that's a good sort of, after you do all these different class rates, credits, applications of different tax rates to different bases, where you end up with, and you can see by far, and this graph makes it clear, the ag property is probably the most favored in terms of the relative amount of tax that plays the market value, and commercial industrial is the most disadvantaged by the class rate system.
Excuse me, Representative Mori.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Either of you, I just noticed something. I thought we still had 4D. Do we just call it something else now, or...
No, we do still have 4D. We didn't. We just listed the primary one on the page, but 4D has come back in fairly recently. I guess on page 14, we should have listed a 4D, and we didn't.
Yeah.
But 4D, the class rate for 4D property, low income rental housing, is 0.75%. So that would actually come in generally probably even below Homestead in terms of tax per dollar of value.
Thank you for raising that.
Yeah.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm also looking at the seasonal recreational property being 4.5 on the estimated market value and then 2.8 on the property taxes. And can you tell me, was that done recently, or was seasonal rec a considerable amount higher? Because it's my understanding we had some recent changes.
Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the seasonal rec property, you know, it's actually been holding, its share of the total state tax burden has been holding fairly steadily at that 2.5% to 3% rate for some time. Its value has been growing very rapidly. We did make a number of changes in that. We changed significantly how we taxed that property in the 2001 reform, and then I believe it was in 2005 we gave them we gave seasonal recreational property a little bit of a break on its portion that it pays of the statewide tax. So we have been making some alterations in that. The share of market value keeps going up, the share of tax is staying somewhat similar.
Thank you. Mr. Hines and Representative Hillstrom, maybe Representative Lanning would like a sentence or two on this issue. I think that was his legislation. He can summarize quickly what really took place in the cabin tax change that you're referencing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What had been happening over a period of time was the share of the state's general property tax paid by seasonal rec had more than doubled over a period of time, and that was a trend line that was of great concern. And so the changes we made in 2005 capped that at 5% of the total state general tax. Commercial industrial still pays 95%, but it had been as high as Mr. Hines helped me out, I think 92, 93,
yeah.
8%, 7-8%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom and Lanning, we'll cover the state general levy a little later on, and we can touch on that a little bit further at that
point.
That'd
be great. Okay, thank you, Representative Hart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doesn't this include the state general in these figures?
Madam Chair, Representative Hart, yes, that does include that.
Okay.
Maybe I should have mentioned too on that one slide that shows the tax on a $200,000 property, seasonal rec is listed there, and seasonal rec is even though its class rate is the same as Homestead at 1%, it actually has a very different class tax structure because it pays the general tax, whereas the Homestead doesn't. It doesn't pay referendum tax, whereas the homes do. It doesn't receive the Homestead credit. You can see where it ends up in this hypothetical example. Its tax burden is a little higher, is a bit higher than a home of the same value, but not so much. The next chart then is now sort of changing our focus from who pays the tax to where does the property tax money go? And the slide on page 17 of the longer, or the chart on page 17 of the longer handout, or on slide 15, shows where the property tax revenues go by type of government. You can see that now in 2006, counties account for the largest share of property tax revenues at about 31.5%, about almost a third. School districts now are up to approximately a quarter, and cities are also near a quarter, depending upon how you count TIF revenues. We kind of show them in there with a dotted line that those are revenues you can't attribute to the city, but they don't go to the city's general fund. And without, if you exclude those, then cities are at about 21%.
Excuse me, Representative Fulmer.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hines, when did the state start collecting property tax? Was that 2001?
Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Representative Fulmer, calendar year 2002. It was part of the 2001 reform.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hines, what does this chart look like in 2001 then? What are the significant changes, I guess?
Madam
yes,
Chair,
Mr. Hines
Representative
and
Broad.
Representative Rukavina is mentioning the school districts. I'm sure Representative Broad wants that.
I'm not sure exactly what it looked like, but the school piece would be much smaller. And the other pieces, I think, would be sort of proportionately larger. Beyond that, I have plenty of data on that, but I don't have it.
Mr. Hines, could we get that, actually? I think Representative Broad raises a good question, just maybe at the next meeting in members' folders. I think that would be worth taking a look at. Representative Broad, did you have further on that? No? Okay. Representative Rukavina?
Sure, I'd say, other than the fact that I think that everybody thought, and the cabin owners were lobbying the legislature that their taxes were going to go down after the 2001 tax bill, and exactly the opposite happened. So Representative Earhart didn't get that tax cut that he thought he was going to, when he thought he was going to lose the school districts up in northern Minnesota.
Representative Earhart.
Well, Madam Chair, I have those figures, and I'll bring them in and show how much you were up there, your school district, for robbing the rest of us.
Representative Rukavina.
Representative Earhart, you own property in northern Minnesota, and I always said you should pay for educating the people up there, because someday you may end up in an ambulance in your cabin and the kid can't read the instructions on the defibrillator and you're going to be dead. So how cheap were you then?
A prelude of things to come, members. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, looking at the seasonal residential section again, this is my first time on the tax committee for all of you. When I ask this question, I hope you'll bear with me a little bit. But it looks like up to a $500,000 cabin is at the same rate as a residential homestead, except they are not subject to the referendum and levies. So I guess if I could get some examples maybe later, so that I can actually see whether seasonal rec is paying less than homesteads when you add those two levies, or because of, I'm not sure about what the business rate is or this state property tax value is, it would be helpful so that we could see, where it falls on the chart of who's paying how much. That would be helpful.
Mr. Hines, I think.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that, again, the chart on page 15 of the longer document does show for, if it was located in the same jurisdiction, what a seasonal recreational property valued at $200,000 would pay compared to a home, sort of some attempt at sort of bringing all those factors into the equation, so you can see it would end up in this example of these tax rates chosen somewhat higher than home.
Madam Chair,
Representative Hillstrom,
thank you. So in clarifying this, then, so the residential home portion would also include the education piece, or not, on this chart?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, this would, the chart shows the net tax, including the state tax, including after taking away the homestead, subtracting the homestead credit. So it would be the net tax bill that the taxpayer would be facing in that property.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification. The seasonal rec is paying the state general tax, whereas the homestead is not. And that causes quite a difference in the tax paid.
But, Madam Chair,
Representative Rukavina,
to this point, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think I know what Representative Hillstrom is trying to ask. And Mr. Hines, you didn't factor in, let's say, in this taxing jurisdiction here where you have all these numbers on a $200,000 home, cabin, whatever, if there's an operating levy that was passed, then what happens to the equation between the seasonal rec and the residential homestead? Because might not that homestead pay more than the cabin because they don't pay the operating levy?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, this, I should have explained this more, but this chart is using a average tax rates in the state, which includes an average referendum tax rate, the sort of first footnote on that table. It is using a referendum tax rate of 0.15%. So it is assuming some level of a referendum tax. But you make a good point. The higher the level of that referendum tax would be,
then the better deal the cabin is getting relative to the home, and vice versa. If a cabin's located in a district where there's no operating referendum, then the cabin is really paying quite a bit higher tax than the home, because they're not benefiting. They're still paying that full state rate, but no seasonal. So it does depend on that, but this example does assume an average rate of a referendum tax. And while I'm at it, Ms. Baker suggests that I should sort of try to describe that last column, the effective tax rate in that table, which is a common measure that we use when comparing tax burdens across type of properties and across properties
of
different values.
Excuse me. Can members all see what he's looking at? It's not on the screen up there. And I think this is important. Effective tax rate, page 15, last column. And members should know that as organizations that have met with me this year from the whole gamut of property tax, I've asked them to present their data in effective tax rates. This is the one way, and there are, you know, in a perfect world, better measures, but we don't have better data, that members can say for $1,000 of property value, what's the rate, depending where you're looking on different kinds of property across the state. So if you can find that effective tax rate column, that really is about the best way we can look at burden or incidence. So this effective tax rate concept will recur throughout the debate this year, and members should try to understand that on page 15.
Yes, Madam Chair, it's simply defined as the ratio of the tax to the value of the property. And so in these examples, the lowest effective tax rate we have, the Ag Homestead at a 0.44% effective rate, meaning that for each dollar of value of Ag Homestead, they're paying less than half a percent of that in tax. Compared to the home, which is generally in this example 1.05%, and we generally think of homes as being around 1%. So about what on average in the state, homes pay about 1% of their value in tax. Now it varies quite a bit from place to place and by value, but it's just a good way to compare across jurisdictions and across properties of different value to discuss tax burdens.
Thank you. And now are we moving on to school districts? First, Representative Wolschlager has a question.
Chair members, just a quick question on the agriculture. Is that 1 acre? What's the unit?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Wolschlager, the example on that table, and the second footnote covers that, it assumes that the house is valued at $50,000, so the house garage in 1 acre is valued at $50,000. And the rest of the ag property is $150,000 for a $200,000 total. And you're sort of reading past your question. There could be many different configurations of ag property that could get you to $200,000. This was just choosing an example for this purpose. The more the value of the property that's in the ag land, the lower the tax would be. The more it's a house garage in 1 acre, the higher the tax burden would be. But you do have to make assumptions about what the constitution of that ag homestead is. But this is including the tax on a $200,000 property.
Mr. Hines, looking at the clock and knowing we're adjourning in 13 minutes, it would be great if we could quickly go through the school district state general tax, because we've covered that, not take questions on those because they're quick. I think before we adjourn, we do want to begin the discussion of the major property tax relief programs, which tend to be of most interest to members. So if we could try to spend the bulk of the rest of time on the LGA and the county aid and working through those big programs. Mr. Hines.
Did you say just touch briefly on the school levy?
Right.
Okay. And I did want to point out that, Representative Rodwin, your question, I interpreted you as saying right after the 2001 reform is 2002,
mm-hmm.
but did you mean before 2001?
Right.
And then one?
Right.
And then I gave exactly the wrong answer, because the school district would be more like half a typical burden before. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
Going to then slide on page slide 16, the school district levies, just wanted to point out a couple different things. The two biggest school district levies, and of course this isn't generally the purview of this committee, but we do need to pay attention to it, and we do pay attention to it more and more each year, I think. The two biggest categories of levy are the debt service levy at 35% and the operating referendum at about 29%. Those two together are about two-thirds of the total, and those two are also the two that are voter-approved. So approximately two-thirds of school district levies now are voter-approved levies versus the other one-third that are not. And then the other, the hatched sections of the pie are the ones that are spread on referendum market value as opposed to the rest, which are spread on tax capacity. So the ones on referendum market value mean that a higher percentage of that burden falls on homes than on CI compared to the other. And also that's the part that ag properties and seasonal rec properties are exempt from, that hatched part, which again is about a third of the total. The next slide relates to the state general tax. It's about $700 million for calendar year 2007. It increases each year by inflation, applies to commercial, industrial, and seasonal rec only. And beginning, as we had this discussion before, starting with 2006, we fixed the shares so that 95% will always be allocated on CI property versus 5% on seasonal rec property. Before that, there hadn't been an explicit allocation, and as Representative Lanning referred to, that those relationships had got up to about 92% commercial, industrial, and 8% seasonal, whereas they had started in 2002 more like 95.5 or 96.4 or something like that. And the chart on the bigger handout shows that the tax rates have been doing have been falling each year because the levy is growing slower than the tax base.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. And members, we're going to jump to LGA County Aid, market value credits, property tax refund, and kick it off with Ms. Dalton here. If you're looking at me like, no.
Okay, Ms. Schill. Thank you, Madam Chair. The table on pages 18 and 19 provides a summary of Minnesota's existing property tax relief programs, their annual costs, and who benefits. Notice how the programs are organized according to three program types. Aids are on page 18. Credits and refunds are on page 19. Property tax aids are intended to replace property tax levy income with state payment for local taxing jurisdictions. Property tax credits reduce the property tax liabilities for individual taxpayers. Local taxing districts receive state payment for these credits. Property tax refunds are direct payments to homeowners from the state. In all cases, the effect is that the property tax payers pay less than what the taxes would be otherwise, and the state makes up the difference. And that's part of my job. Fiscal staff will keep track of this kind of spending on an aids and credits portion of the spreadsheet. I pointed out that to you yesterday. We'll have an update of that as it becomes available with the February forecast. Of all the property tax relief programs, LGA is by far the largest, with funding of $485 million per year. Second are the property tax relief payments, with totaling $363 million. And third are the market value credits at $297, fourth with county program aid at $205. And now I'm turning it over to Ms. Dalton for more information.
Thank you. And as we go to Ms. Dalton, I know that Representative Tilbury has diligently worked on the minutes throughout this meeting and is ready to move the minutes if the body has also had a chance to look at them. We want to get those approved before we adjourn. So, Representative Tilbury.
Yeah, I move that we accept the minutes.
Thank you. There's a motion to approve the minutes. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries. One opposed. Motion carries. And so, members, and we do have a quorum, so we did take action with that quorum, and therefore, we're going to spend the rest of the time with Ms. Dalton now before we adjourn. Thank you, Ms. Dalton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. And before we go on with this, I actually want to draw your attention to something that's the single sheet that's in your packet. And this is a brand new, I call it a toy. All the rest of you will call it a tool. I think it's very cool. It's on our website for House Research, and it's an interactive lookup table for local government aid. You can look it up by cities. You can look it up by all the cities in the county. You can get a list of all of the cities that have similar characteristics, like large suburbs. You can ask for any and all years between 2002 and 2007. You can get it by total aid amounts or by per capita amounts. And you can also have it printed out as an Excel spreadsheet if you want to play with it.
Ms. Dalton, and may I say that we want to encourage members, particularly the Property Tax Division, as they put their report together, to not trash the system with dueling amendments. I think we can anticipate Representative Earhart and Rukavina and others will be using that data, and I encourage all of you to. It's really quite a tool, members, where we're actually going to not have to wait for big run information, which the committee's used to. We'll still need them. But for members to work with their cities and understanding what does their city get and pay whatever and what did they get, it's all now on the web. And we want the public to jump on there and take a look, too. It'll be very interesting. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we were doing these in 2001, I not only looked at the cities, but I looked at the individual property taxes that were being paid by each member of the tax committee. So we had a little, I remember Europe, wow.
Members, that's another model. Representative Earhart, do you know Representative Rukavina's property taxes for the record this year? And members, we're kind of joking around here, but for most of us, depending on the county we reside in, that is public information. As you know, if you go to your county assessor site, you can type in an address and you can see the property taxes paid. That's public information. By member, it's sometime been delivered to the tax committee where you can see everybody's property taxes, and that is public information. I don't think we have it quite that interactive across the whole state, but I know those of us who reside in Hennepin have been aware that that information has been public for many years. So Representative Earhart is on to another tool that's available to you. Representative Rukavina?
Well, Madam Chair, there are four members of this committee, I think, that have enjoyed spending time at my house, and they all think I pay too much in taxes. Including the chair. Oh, I am.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the one thing I do want to say is this is our first foray into an interactive website. We will not be putting proposals. So if somebody, like the governor's proposal for LGA, that will not show up. This will only have the certified numbers at this point because, as I said, this is kind of an experiment. But I think it's a fun experiment. So when you have, you know, the what happened in my five cities for the last 5 years, you can actually go to the website and find it out without having to call somebody and wait for one of us to return your call. Anyway, local government aid, as I said, it's the largest general purpose aid program to local governments. It is a city aid program only, although it was originally set up as a program to everybody, all local governments. It's been pretty much a city aid program for the last several years. The big changes occurred to this program in the 2003 session. In 2003, LGA was originally certified at $587 million. I actually went to the next slide. But because of the budget crisis, the actual payments were reduced to $465 million. They were further reduced to $424 million in 2004, plus $8 million of transition aid. And 2004 is where we actually had a major change in how LGA is distributed. The LGA appropriation was supposed to stay at $437 million in perpetuity or until you guys changed it. The legislature changed it in 2006 to $484 million, and that's the current level. Prior to 2003...
Excuse me. Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair, I just have a quick question. Has the legislature or the governor ever in history mandated how cities are supposed to use the LGA?
Madam Chair, Representative Kamar, not that I'm aware of, but I have not done this since 1972 when the program was first instituted, but at least not since I've been around it since 1987.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. I think Representative Kamar will ask that question again tomorrow when we're all here together again for the governor's tax recommendations. I think he's read ahead and understands what the governor's proposing. Ms. Dalton.
One of the changes which you will probably hear a lot about is prior to 2003, there was an automatic inflator in the LGA appropriation. The LGA appropriation used to go up between 2.5% and 5% a year, depending on what the level of inflation was. That no longer is the case. The other major change is that under the old law, 60% of the money that was paid out in LGA in 2003 was grandfathered aid. It was based on what cities had gotten primarily in 1993. 40% of it was distributed via the formula. So the big change now is only $30 million of aid is distributed off the formula, and the remaining $454 million is actually distributed by the formula. To the extent that, you know, people believe in the formula, that's probably a good thing, because it is essentially directing money to cities based on need and their ability to raise revenue locally. But there have been some other issues that have been caused by this. Volatility is one of them, which we will talk about. In your large packet, there is actually, I'd like to direct your attention to page 23, which has the one table cheat sheet on what happened between old law and new law. As I said, the main, the majority of LGA is distributed based on measures of need minus measures of ability to pay. For small cities, need is based on four factors: population, population decline, housing built before 1940, and percent of property that's classified as commercial or industrial. Those are the four factors that were actually used in the formula that was adopted back in 1993. All that happened for the small city need formula is that they updated the coefficients, but no one did a really big analysis of, is this the best way to measure need for small cities. For large cities, the governor did, and the Department of Revenue, did actually do a statistical analysis to come up with a new measure of city need for large cities. And for those people who are new to the committee, you will often hear me talk about small cities and large cities. Small cities are cities with a population under 2,500. That is a little over 600 of the 854 cities in this state. And then the remaining cities are the large cities which have a population of 2,500 or more. Their new formula is based on population decline, percent of housing built before 1940, road accident factors, household size, and whether the city is in the metropolitan area or not. And I'm just waiting for Representative Rukavina to make it.
We're going to adjourn here in a minute. I do want to give Representative Rukavina a chance to jump in here on that. That's a good way to close and tell members that we're all going to be together again tomorrow. We'll finish property tax, and then we're going to hear the governor's recommendations. I think what I'll ask Commissioner Ines to do is begin with the property tax component of the governor's recommendation so that the division who is here can hear that. Representative Rukavina, the last word for city LGA need factors for large cities.
Madam Chair, when I found out that the accidents had to be over $1,000 in value, I scrapped my idea to put up a springing stop sign that everybody in Virginia could run into and then claim an accident so we could get our LGA payments up. But there was a little factor in there that it had to be over $1,000.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. We are adjourned.